Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. It's really, 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 really hot in this studio. My name is Karl Ozhovsky, and I'll be taking you through the next hour and sweating all the way. On today's program, we are going to be speaking with Daniel Brister. Daniel is the head of the Buffalo Field Campaign, based out of Yellowstone National Park, and we're going to be talking with him about buffalo, aka bison. We're going to be speaking with him about the wild bison population in Yellowstone National Park, the challenges they're facing, and the work that Daniel is doing to make Yellowstone a bit of a better place for the wild bison. But in the meantime, of course, as always, we got to get to some announcements and some news. So the first announcement coming to us from our good friend Bob Timmons, great guy in the Toronto AR community. He's having a screening this upcoming Thursday at the University of Toronto Bauhin Center. It is the Toronto premiere of Shannon Keith's movie Skin Trade. Now, if you've listened to Animal Voices, you know that we've just recently interviewed Shannon about the film. It's really excellent. If you haven't seen it yet, this is a perfect time to do it. Please share this info as well, far and wide. We're trying to help Shannon continue her amazing work, and this is a fundraiser for her organization. So the movie will be $7, and we're trying to fill the seats. There are approximately 130 seats for the viewing, so do check it out. It's happening at the University of Toronto Bauhin Center, Thursday, July 8th. That's this upcoming Thursday, and the address is 40 St. George Street. It's near the College Street area, room 1170. So again, that's the Bauhin Center, Thursday, July 8th, 40 St. George Street, room 1170, and it's happening from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. The movie starts at 7:30. There is a Facebook event, so if you're on the Facebook, do RSVP. And now let's get to some news. Interesting week for animal news this week. The first story coming to us from the Calgary Herald. An odd place to be printing this kind of story, I guess, but the headline is, "Lonely but steadfast anti-rodeo activists say support is growing." As the rituals of summer kicked off this weekend, a hidebound annual tradition once again took to the streets. With the Calgary Stampede approaching, animal rights activists are trying to raise awareness about rodeo cruelty. This year, they're hoping for a less aggressive response from skeptical passers-by and the wandering public. Quote, "Every year animals are hurt, killed, and scared out of their minds for the sake of entertainment. That's what we want to see end," said Jeremy Thomas, who has been protesting against the rodeo for a decade. He was one of eight protesters who turned up for the event, which was organized over the internet. Quote, "People seem to think of us as extreme, but we're very normal and very reasonable. It's just that we don't want to see animals suffering. An ethical stampede would ban the rodeo altogether," he said. Although anti-rodeo activism doesn't have a large following in Calgary, other animal rights groups are starting to heed the call. After its 2007 success ending rope events at the Cloverdale Rodeo in BC, the Vancouver Humane Society has set its sights on the Calgary Stampede. Although the society has not sent staff members to observe or research stampede conditions firsthand, Peter Fricker, the society's project and communications director, said they rely on the accounts of activists and scientific research to support a ban on calf roping. Quote, "We're taking a 3 to 4 month old animal, an immature animal, sending them out of a chute into a closed circuit, roping them and taking them to the ground," he said. "In our view, that's an inhumane treatment of an animal." Thomas said the rodeo does not reflect the values of most Canadians, a view that the Stampede staff refute. A spokesperson for the Stampede, who asked not to be named, said the almost 100-year-old organization respects the protesters' right to express their opinions. However, quote, "We think millions of Canadians would disagree," he said. "There are hundreds of rodeos that take place every year." Last month, the Stampede announced it would change a rule in the steer wrestling event to help prevent animal injuries. Occasionally, when cattle are wrestled, they fall with their legs underneath their bellies in what is known as a dog fall. This increases the risk of the animal's spine snapping during an event. Under the new rules, a steer must now be thrown with its head and feet facing in the same direction. Thomas and his posse of animal rights activists remain skeptical. Quote, "We believe the changes they've made are superficial," he said. The handful of protesters did not seem to be convincing many passers-by. Lyndon Dunkley, 39, an oil and gas strategist at an investment bank, said his family has a farm in Saskatchewan and has witnessed the branding and roping of many animals. Quote, "It's crazy for them to be protesting something that does this great thing for the city," he said. However, Thomas believes Calgarians are becoming more sympathetic to his cause. In almost a decade of protesting, he's noticed the public become less aggressive over the years. He said he would continue to object to the rodeo throughout the stampede, which begins Friday. Quote, if your photographer arrives early, he might be lucky enough to catch people throwing cans at us. And the next story coming to us from the BBC. The headline is, Animal Rights Campaigner Denies University Bomb Plot. And if you have been following this story, you'll recognize the name. Mel Broughton, 50, of Semi Long Road, Northampton, allegedly targeted Queen's College Sports Pavilion in 2006 and Templeton College the following year. He told the jury that he had set up a campaign group to oppose Oxford University's plans for a research laboratory. Mr. Broughton denies a charge of conspiracy to commit arson. The jury at Oxford Crown Court was told how Mr. Broughton had pleaded guilty to being in possession of firebombs in 1998 and was jailed for 4 years. Taking the stand, he said, quote, I am no longer involved in that type of action. I do understand why people break the law to help animals. It would be hypocritical to say I don't understand it. I do, but I am no longer involved. David Bentley, defending Mr. Broughton, asked him, were you there with a propensity to use firebombs? He said, no, I wasn't. Mr. Bentley then asked what had changed. He replied, I am a lot older. For me, it's no longer something I am willing or able to do. As well as conspiracy to commit arson, Mr. Broughton also denies an alternative charge of possession of an article with intent to destroy property. And the trial continues. The last story today coming to us from newsobserver.com. The headline is, Puppy Mills Escape Again. Check this out. A bill aimed at combating puppy mills by regulating commercial dog breeders in the state has failed for the second straight year, in part due to opposition from an industry that doesn't deal in dogs, the state's pork producers. The North Carolina Pork Council, which represents a $2.2 billion industry in the state, opposed Senate Bill 460, which sought to, quote, eliminate abusive practices and provide for the humane care and treatment of dogs and puppies by establishing standards for their care at commercial breeding operations. Doesn't sound too controversial, I guess. Angie Whitener, the Pork Council's lobbyist, said her group does not oppose the bill so much as the bill's main backers, the Humane Society of the United States. Quote, our opposition is solely based on the proponent of the bill, Whitener said. We're very worried about this powerful, very wealthy animal rights organization. The bill, which does not address livestock, was narrowly approved by the Senate last year. The House sent it to the Finance Committee, where it stalled this week because, according to the chairman, it was, quote, too divisive. There was a lot of acrimony, and we decided, as chairs, not to take it up, said Representative Paul Lupka, a Durham Democrat and the House Finance Committee's senior chairman. It seems to make more sense to start over in 2011 and try to build a consensus bill. The Humane Society estimates there are about 300 puppy mills operating in the state that go largely unnoticed because owners sell the dogs on the internet. Last year, authorities rescued hundreds of dogs from an alleged Wayne County puppy mill. And in April, Guilford County Sheriff's deputies seized nearly 100 dogs from a breeding kennel whose owner was indicted last month on 12 counts of cruelty to animals, according to the Greensboro News and Record. The bill would define a commercial breeder as someone who sells dogs and has 15 or more female dogs and 30 or more puppies. It calls for these operations to provide daily exercise, vet care, and appropriate housing and record keeping. The bill would also require commercial breeders to register with the state's Department of Agriculture and give counties authority to investigate violations related to commercial breeding operations. Senator Don Davis, a Greene County Democrat who sponsored the bill in the Senate, said it was meant to, quote, take precautionary measures to make sure dogs are not kept in the worst conditions. Pet shops and animal shelters in the states are subject to similar regulations, he said. Whitener said the bill was about more than just dogs. She said she believes the Humane Society's end goal is to eventually stop meat production for human consumption. Whitener noted the Humane Society of the U.S. sponsored Proposition 2, a ballot initiative passed 2 years ago in California. Among other regulations, the law requires that calves, chickens, and pigs be kept in areas where they can freely lie down, stand up, and fully extend their limbs. It was intended to ban the use of tightly confining crates for breeding sows and cages for hens. Californians overwhelmingly approved the ballot measure. Whitener also pointed to a press release on the Humane Society's website that said the organization had purchased stock in Krispy Kreme donuts and planned to encourage Krispy Kreme to move away from egg suppliers that confine their hens in cages. Quote, this shows their true intentions in North Carolina, Whitener said. But Kim Albom, the Humane Society's lobbyist who has been trying to get the bill passed, said North Carolina is not a ballot measure state, so it could not replicate something like California's Proposition 2. And SB 460, quote, was just about the thousands of dogs that are suffering in puppy mills in North Carolina. The slippery slope argument is insulting to our legislators because they vote on the merits of each individual bill. Because they vote to regulate this unregulated industry does not mean they are going to vote for every animal bill. So there you have it, the puppy mill bill struck down by pork producers. It's a strange world we're living in, my friends. You are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM, and once again today we are speaking with Daniel Brister, head of the Buffalo Field Campaign, about buffalo slaughter in Yellowstone National Park. I do hope you'll stick around. We're going to go to some music. If you have any questions or comments about the news that you've heard, do drop us a line, animalvoices@gmail.com. And if you want to download some past programs, we've got over 300 online. Check out our website, www.animalvoices.ca. In the meantime, here's some Tanya Tagak, and the song is Fire Ikuma. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. That was the second track from Tanya Tagak's amazing album, Ok Blood. The track is called Fire Ikuma, and it features Mike Patton on vocals, and we're back on Animal Voices. On today's program, I'm extremely happy to have Daniel Brister. He is the executive director of the Buffalo Field Campaign, and among the many things that they do, one of their main goals is to stop the slaughter of wild bison in Yellowstone National Park. Daniel, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
The first question I wanted to ask you, and it's a question that we tend to ask of all of our guests, is how did you get into animal issues, and I guess specifically, how did you become interested in buffalo conservation?
Well, I'd always been interested in environmental issues and, you know, just from seeing what was happening all around me. And when I first moved to Montana in the 90s, that was a very bad year for the bison. They were all in the news. I remember seeing a tally at the local university, and it said, you know, 500 wild bison have been killed this year. At that time, I didn't even know that there was anywhere where wild bison had survived. And as that winter went on, that number grew to over 1,100. And it really hit me personally, and I felt that I needed to get involved and learn more about the issue and do something to protect the buffalo. So I've been involved ever since. It's almost 15 years now.
For our listeners, because you're using the words buffalo and bison interchangeably, can you explain the difference or lack of difference between the two?
Sure. Scientists refer to the species as bison. Their scientific name is bison bison. But in America, they have kind of come to be called buffalo. But when I use the two words, I'm meaning the same species, the native bison that are indigenous to the Great Plains of the Americas.
I'm imagining that for some of our listeners listening to the program, they are understanding what you're saying, and they're hearing that buffalo are being slaughtered in the U.S., but they may not be sure why. Why would buffalo be slaughtered at all, and specifically why in Yellowstone?
Well, there is a great and long discrimination against native species in this country, particularly bison. You know, in the 19th century, there was a direct connection made by military officials trying to get the tribal people to settle on reservations and to adopt a more European way of life. And the thing that made their nomadic lifestyle possible was the bison. And these tribes, their entire life were based upon the migrations of bison. And they were a migratory people that followed the movement of bison. So, you know, originally, one of the factors that contributed to the bison's near eradication was, you know, this effort to settle the Native Americans, and as they put it back then, settle the vexed Indian question. So that is, I believe, still going on, that discrimination, as well as the efforts that were made by Europeans to clear the plains of this native species and introduce imported cattle, which, you know, didn't evolve with the ecosystem. And it, from from an economic, purely economic standpoint, it was a very bad choice because you were replacing one hardy species that could survive on the plains with one that developed elsewhere and really couldn't survive the harsh conditions out there. You know, that's a little of the history behind it. And as far as today's slaughter, what's going on is Yellowstone National Park is the very high volcanic plateau, and it's surrounded by lower elevation lands, and much of the park's wildlife needs to migrate out of the park in order to survive the winter. When the bison migrate out of Yellowstone, they enter Montana, and then the management authority changes from being managed by the National Park Service to being managed by the Montana Department of Livestock, whose interest is in perpetuating and promoting the livestock industry in Montana. So they view bison in Montana kind of as a competition for grass, and subsequently the bison are killed when they migrate into Montana. So the official reason given for the slaughter is this disease called brucellosis, but bison have never transmitted the disease to domestic cattle in the wild ever.
Can you set the scene for us? So what does the sort of transition from Yellowstone National Park into the plains of Montana look like? Is Yellowstone kind of fenced in a way, or this is sort of, it's a national park, but there's more or less a sort of free passage in between the sort of unprotected areas and the protected areas?
Well, it's interesting because in the early part of the 20th century, the U.S. Congress recognized that Yellowstone was not a complete ecosystem, and the boundary lines are a straight line that were drawn across a map with a ruler. So basically all of the species in the park need to migrate outside of Yellowstone. And in that recognition, Congress surrounded Yellowstone with a lot of national forest land, which is also public land. Unfortunately, in the intervening years, the livestock industry has really gotten a hold of those national forest lands. So there is a perception that although they are public lands, cattle grazing is okay on those lands. They really set up this conflict. But bison are the only species that are expected to stay within Yellowstone. There's no fence. The management actions are their own kind of fence. You know, whenever bison step out of the park, they're either chased with helicopters or all-terrain vehicles or people on horseback back into the park, or worse, just shot right out in the field or rounded up into these big capture facilities and then shipped to slaughterhouses.
So more or less, the Yellowstone National Park is a protected area, but as soon as they step over the boundary, it's sort of, no pun intended, fair game.
Yes, for the most part, that holds pretty clear, especially on the west side of the park. Actually, on the north side of Yellowstone, in Yellowstone National Park, there is a bison trap now. So when the animals just approach that north boundary, they don't even have to have left the park. They can also be rounded up and shipped to slaughter from within the park, though.
Maybe can we talk a little bit about the bison themselves? How important is this area for them? I imagine that as far as bison as a species, there aren't too many areas left where they're safe. Do they have areas outside of Yellowstone and beyond Montana where they live?
Yes, this area is very important to the bison. Just a little of the history. At the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century, there were only about 25 bison in the wild anywhere in America, and those were in the Pelican Valley of Yellowstone National Park.
I'm sorry, did you say 25?
Yeah, 25 individuals. That's
wow.
How many survived the 19th century. And over the course of the 20th century, those bison, as well as a few that were brought back into Yellowstone from other areas that had been in a captive herd for less than 20 years, those animals basically reproduced into today's bison herd. And today there are approximately between 3,000 and 3,500 bison in Yellowstone. You know, this area is very important to their survival. However, you know, they do need to migrate and access some of these lower elevation valleys. You know, the mountains really are good for them, but they really need to access some of those lower elevation grasslands in order to really thrive. Now, that's what we're pushing for, is their right to access their traditional habitat.
And so when you say 3,000 or so bison at this point, besides those 3,000, are we looking at extinction, more or less? Extinction of wild bison, I guess?
Yes. You know, this bird, I believe, is very threatened just by the management actions and by the fact that they are kept on such a small percentage of their habitat. One thing about Yellowstone bison that makes them special is that they do not have cattle genes, as far as any scientist has ever been able to determine. It's a genetically pure herd in that it hasn't been tainted with cattle genes like a lot of the other herds in the world are.
Daniel, we need to take a very short break to play a station ID, but before we do that, I just wanted to read at the top of the Buffalo Field Campaign website on the right side. If you go to www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, for anybody listening out there that's near a computer, as we've been talking about this, you know, we've been talking a little bit about numbers, you know, 25 bison that survived the 19th century, the 3,000 wild bison that remain, and by the count on the Buffalo Field Campaign website, the total Yellowstone buffalo killed from the winter of 2007 to 2008 was 1,616. So these are just staggering numbers. Honestly, I'm blown away by the math here. So we're going to take a very short break. We're going to be back with Daniel. Daniel, thank you so much for being on the program. If you want to stick around, we'll talk more just after the station ID.
Thanks.
We'll be back in 30 seconds on Animal Voices. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CAUT 89.5 FM. On today's program, we are speaking with Daniel Brister, the executive director of the Buffalo Field Campaign, which is seeking working in the field every day to stop the slaughter of Yellowstone's wild, free-roaming buffalo. Daniel, thank you so much for being on the program, and welcome back. I wanted to talk a little bit about brucellosis again, because you mentioned it briefly in passing, but it seems like a fairly big justification for why so many bison are killed every year. So can you tell our listeners, what is brucellosis and how is it related to the bison?
Well, brucellosis is a European livestock disease that came to North America with cattle. It was first detected in Yellowstone bison in 1917. And since that time, the bison do have the disease, and they have seemed to develop the ability to live with it. You know, it doesn't really affect them. The way brucellosis works is it's a reproductive disease that, in domestic cattle herds, it tends to cause a cow to miscarry her first calf. So it has economic impacts to the livestock industry, and that's the big thing with it. But wild bison have never transmitted brucellosis to domestic livestock. There is a Grand Teton National Park right to the south of Yellowstone. When they created that park, they actually grandfathered in cattle grazing into the park. And for about 50 years, bison and cattle have co-mingled, and there's never been a case of bison transmitting the disease to livestock. The livestock industry, I believe, uses brucellosis as a big scare tactic to justify the slaughter and harassment of the bison and keeping bison out of Montana. Elk also carry brucellosis, and there are far greater numbers of elk in the ecosystem, and yet elk are allowed to freely migrate from Yellowstone onto public and private lands in Montana and back into Yellowstone again. So again, it seems like there's this great discrimination that is being directed at the bison. The more you look into this issue, the more apparent it becomes that brucellosis is not the big boogeyman that it is feared to be.
And so what do you think the discrimination issue is based around? You touched a little bit before on the idea that, you know, the sort of frontier mentality and sort of wiping out a lot of the native species, not the least of which were Native American populations of people who obviously are not a different species, but what I mean is, you know, in the sense that basically wiping out anything that was different from the settlers. Do you think it's rooted in that mentality?
Yes, I do. I think there are very deep roots to what's going on. I also believe that the organized livestock industry, certainly there are many ranchers on the landscape who actually, you know, they'll tell you that brucellosis is not a fear of theirs and that that they don't mind having bison around, but it seems to be coming more from the real agribusiness, organized part of things. And I think what they fear is this example of the Yellowstone bison re-inhabiting any of their former landscape outside of the park, and then people realizing what a good thing that is, that the bison are good for the land, that they're good for the economy. People would come from miles and miles around to come and view bison on the landscape again. I think that they see that as competition because that would mean less open land for cattle grazing. And so they don't even want to let Pandora out of the box at all, so to speak.
Right.
You know, and they want to just keep Yellowstone a nice, tidy little box where the bison are, and they don't want them stepping outside of the park and expanding their habitat at all.
Is sort of integrating bison into production something that the livestock industry has toyed with? You know, you sometimes see, or I sometimes see up in Canada here, every once in a while you'll go to a restaurant and you'll see that restaurants serve, you know, for example, bison burgers. And I imagine that these are, to some degree, a domesticated version of the bison that are in Yellowstone Park. Is that something that the agribusiness industry in Montana has toyed with at all?
There are bison ranches here, yes, and certainly Ted Turner, who is a large landowner here, he has brought bison back onto some private land to raise them for meat and stuff. But it's, you know, it is a different, those bison on ranches are not, they do have cattle genes as well, and they're not, you know, behaviorally, they're not wild, and genetically, they're not either. You know, there are some differences, but yes, there is a little bit of movement in that direction.
I guess I want to move towards a bit of a discussion about what you do as part of the Buffalo Field Campaign, because we've sort of been setting the scene as far as a background goes. Is there a season? I'm guessing that it has to do with migration patterns. Is there a season where the Buffalo Field Campaign is very active, and what would a typical day in that season look like for you?
Well, we are very active year-round, but our field work, our field season is typically from November until May or June, and that mirrors the migration. Those are the months when the bison are really on the move and when they would be likely to migrate into Montana. And what we do is we have field patrols who go out on cross-country skis mostly or on foot, equipped with cameras, still cameras and video cameras, and we document the bison's migration. And so, you know, we'll ski out in the morning, and based on the previous day's patrols, you locate the group of bison, and then you just stay a good distance away so you're not bothering them at all, but you're in place in case the Department of Livestock or other agencies come out to harass the bison. And then we document everything that happens to them and use that footage and the stories we glean to really build a constituency for the buffalo. And there are people all over the world who care about this herd, and they turn to Buffalo Field Campaign for their information. So, you know, we drive ourselves, try to provide the most accurate and timely information. Based on that information, we then build different actions that people can take to protect the bison, whether it's legislation to give them more access to their habitat or stop the slaughter, or talking to people. We do a lot of outreach tours where we just go around the country and share our footage and get people excited about participating in this movement to protect the bison.
I imagine that some of your interactions with hunters or these sort of wildlife managers is tense.
Yes.
Can you sort of describe what happens in a situation like that where you come across this sort of thing happening?
Yeah, it can be very intense. You know, you can spend weeks out there with a herd and it's beautiful and peaceful, and then one day that is shattered by a helicopter coming and swooping down 10 feet over their backs and chasing them for 20 miles, you know, and it can be very, very intense. But over the years, we've gotten pretty good at it, realizing that it doesn't really do any help to yell or shout at the agents, and sometimes that only escalates things. But, you know, it can be very difficult to find the self-restraint, but, you know, it's just something that we've learned to do better, I guess, as time goes on. But certainly there are still times when it gets very heated, particularly when there are new law enforcement agents on scene who are, you know, not respectful of our rights. We have a right to videotape what goes on, and sometimes they'll issue arbitrary orders and keep us back where we're not able to see and document. And things can get heated, and sometimes there are arrests and things like that. But, you know, it's just a very dynamic situation that you never can predict, really, in the morning until it ever happens.
One of the things that you mention on your website is that you also engage in nonviolent civil disobedience in relationship to this stuff. So could you describe what, in the context of these sort of scenes, what does that mean?
Well, sometimes volunteers who come out, they really have seen enough and they decide that they want to take another step. And so sometimes volunteers will, there was one instance where a group of volunteers erected a series of tripods made out of lodgepole pine trees that basically blocked the one access road to the Horse Butte bison trap. And it prevented the Department of Livestock from going out to that area and capturing bison. So basically just people putting their bodies in between the agents and the bison in order to protect them and to raise awareness. These actions really help to focus media attention on the issue, and they help to bring it before the eyes of a lot more people. Well,
it seems like this is a campaign where it would be crucial to have the support of Indigenous American population and tribes. So can you describe to us a little bit about how Native Americans have a voice in this issue and how they're involved in helping you?
Sure. One of our founders is Rosalie Little Thunder, who is a Lakota elder, and she and Mike Meese, who was a video environmental activist, they got together and formed the Buffalo Field Campaign, and ever since we have, you know, had a very strong Native involvement in our efforts. We work closely with a group called the Intertribal Bison Cooperative, and we have Native American representation in the field and our field patrols, and when we go to Washington, D.C., and, you know, part of our mission is to strengthen the tribal voice in decisions affecting the herd. So we recognize that nobody knows the bison better than the tribal people who evolved with them over the centuries, and it's really foolish to exclude the native voice from management decisions. So we're really working to try to bring the Native American perspective back into the decisions that affect the management of the herd.
And so it seems like the numbers of bison that are dying is still quite high. Do you see this situation sort of improving? And what would be sort of your latest report for either the past year or the year before?
Well, this past winter, there were, I believe it was 7 bison killed versus over 1,600 the year before. And, you know, a lot of that is due to just the fact that when you kill so many, the following year there aren't going to be that many bison migrating. But there are also a lot of things on the ground that have changed. The Horse Butte Peninsula, which is immediately to the west of Yellowstone National Park, hundreds of bison go out there every spring and have their calves. And there used to be a grazing allotment on the national forest land out there, but for the past 6 years or so, there have been no cattle on that public land. And then about 3 years ago, there was a private ranch that was sold, and the new owners declared it a bison safe zone. And they refused to allow the Department of Livestock or other agencies to access their land and harass bison. So now the entire Horse Butte Peninsula has no cattle at any time of year. So the stage out there has been set for allowing bison to be there whenever they want, because there are never any cattle that could ever potentially catch the disease. However, the state still refuses to have tolerance for bison out there. I believe it's only a matter of time before the public gets that message and demands that we allow bison to stay, especially in that area. So, you know, there are things happening on the ground that are paving the way, so to speak, to have bison welcome on the landscape as they should be.
And so what does the sort of political climate look like? Because you've talked about the cattle producers in Montana, and I imagine that they're a fairly powerful lobby, and that industry probably contributes a great deal to the state's economy. And so is this something that you see as sort of a winnable campaign as far as the political end of things go, or do you think it's more a sort of a... Not that it's either or, but do you think it's more leaning towards sort of grassroots, like a hearts and minds sort of campaign?
Yes. I mean, I think that it is ultimately winnable on both fronts, but it's a very long-term struggle. You 2007, we had a sense that we'll need to be here for a few years and let people know what's happening here, and then it will stop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously we have had to readjust our sights a little bit as we realize that this is a very, it's a long-term struggle, and it's going to take endless pressure endlessly applied. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing that Buffalo Field Campaign has demonstrated is that we are in it for the long haul, and we're going to be here as long as it takes, doing our work and getting the information out there. But I think that as time goes on, I do believe that politically things will change. You know, the livestock industry, I believe, is going to realize that it's not bison or cattle, that the two species can coexist to some degree, and there's no need to just kill every bison that wanders out of the park.
At this point, we're down to about the last 2 minutes, and I'm imagining a lot of our listeners are wondering about the range of ways that they can get involved. And it seems like from your website that there are plenty of different ways that people can make themselves available. So can you maybe give people the website once again and let people know how they can help?
Yes, it's www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and there are lots of ways. We send out a weekly email update that keeps people up to date on the latest news and the latest actions that they can take, you know, when it's really important that we contact a certain office and urge them to protect the bison. We will have those messages in there, and people, you know, that's our real grassroots strength, is in the thousands of people all over the world who take action for the buffalo, and that's how things will change. So our website has lots of information about how you can plug into those email updates, as well as the latest information on the herd and what's going on.
Apart from that email update, if people wanted to get involved on a more sort of hands-on level, you mentioned that people do volunteer for the program. Can you maybe explain a bit of the process to do with that? Because we do have quite a few listeners in the U.S. of our podcast.
Great. Yeah, we're always encourage people to come out into the West Yellowstone area and volunteer with us. That's the best way to learn about the issue and to really witness firsthand what's going on. If you visit our website, there's information on there about volunteering. You can also just send an email to buffalo@wildrockies.org, and that will get going. That we have a small application process, and then, you know, that's our lifeblood, are the volunteers who come and stand with the buffalo. So I would encourage anybody who's interested to look into it and get in touch.
Daniel, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. It's been really, really great talking to you. Having done some research on the topic before the interview and hearing you talk about it has been, you know, reading about it is one thing, but hearing you describe some of the things that you've seen and the situation in your own words has been really powerful, and I really appreciate you being on the program.
Great. Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I would encourage listeners to go on the site and look at our video as well, because that really takes it to another level.
Excellent. Thank you so much, and take care.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Daniel Brister. He is the executive director of the Buffalo Field Campaign, a campaign that works to protect wild buffalo / bison in the Great Plains, specifically in Yellowstone National Park. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CAUT 89.5 FM. It's really damn hot in this studio, and it's going to keep getting hotter because there's hot jams coming up. Stick around.